I know this is all very confusing to you, so I'll attempt to explain. You are on the starship USS Enterprise.
American?
No, it's a vessel in the United Federation of Planets, and Earth is a member.
A lot has changed in the past 300 years. People are no longer obsessed with the accumulation of things. We have eliminated hunger, want, the need for possessions. We've grown out of our infancy.
What will I do? How will I live?
This is the 24th century. Material needs no longer exist.
Then what's the challenge?
The challenge, Mr. Offenhaus, is to improve yourself. To enrich yourself. Enjoy it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Pop Culture Ninja. I'm Nathan, here with Nathan. Nathan, what's going on, man?
Well, we are here in my own house. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I'm doing great. It's been a bit of a long week, but I'm happy to be here and podcasting again. It's been a couple of weeks since we have been.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're down here drinking this fabulous beer from Colorado, Left Hand Oktoberfest. Dude, this is a dank beer. I forget how much I love this time of the year for beer.
Well, October, yeah, Oktoberfest, yeah.
The Oktoberfest. I'm down with the pumpkin stuff, too. I really do like it. And tonight, it is, we had a great day today, 70 degrees, no humidity.
It was like a nice precursor to fall. I hope it holds. We're going away to the Poconos this weekend, so I'm hoping that we have nice weather for all of that.
Absolutely. And speaking of beer, we just want to let everyone know, don't forget September 24th, so just about a week from when this podcast is being released, is the Beer Fest at Honey Go Wine and Spirits. We did make the announcement for the winners. We put those on Facebook, Twitter, and then we also made that announcement on the These Go to 11 podcast because you and I weren't podcasting that week because you were actually away on vacation. So
yeah, I was being a slacker. Sorry.
Totally all right. But we did make those announcements. Congratulations to the guys who won that. And don't forget to go ahead and grab your tickets because both Nathan and I from here over at Pop Culture Ninja, we will be at the Beer Fest. And then Greg Dutcher and I from These Go to 11 will be there as well. So, you know, the three of us will be there. We'll be hanging out, drinking beer, having a good time. So,
yeah, we'd love for you to come out and see us. It'd be cool to meet some people.
Yeah.
That's always a cool part of doing the podcast is to meet the fans and whatnot.
Yep, absolutely. So we don't want to be terribly long with the announcements because I am really excited about what we're going to be talking about today. So utopias, Nathan, we spent a podcast talking about dystopias,
which feels like a long time ago now.
It does.
It's hard to realize we've recorded getting close to 25, about a quarter of these things. And I just want to say too, that I think we're going to be on a much more regular schedule now. We've sort of cleared out of the woods of the summer vacations and everything like that. So we should be back soon and back with our regular, I think next week we'll be back kind of with two podcasts at a time. We were cranking them out there for a while. We've slowed a little bit, so I'm really happy to be back doing this.
For those of you TV people out there, just think of this as the summer lull,
and now we're getting back season, into the fall. Season two is about where I guess technically we were the season replacement because we started in May off of These Go to 11. But in the summer, we did do a dystopia one, which you can go back and listen to, and I'm not for certain, but it's probably like episode 8, between 8 and 11, somewhere in there.
Yep.
And I think we kind of went through, we defined dystopias a little bit. We talked about, in that particular episode, we talked about two movies, I think, Gattaca and The Lobster.
Yes.
Both movies, The Lobster is now out. You can get it from Redbox. I noticed the other day, I'm like, man, this is going to be some baffled people who take that home on a whim. But and we talked about both of those movies. You can go back and check that podcast out. Tonight we're talking about the flip side of that, something that I don't think gets talked about a lot, which is, Nathan, like you said, utopia, which if dystopia is the society where there is a fundamental flaw, and sometimes people think of it as where everything is wrong. It's the problem with dystopia is coined as a phrase. It's the opposite of a utopia.
Yeah, exactly.
And utopia is where everything is sort of right, not just right, but better than we have it right now. Kind of, I think utopia too inspires the idea of an ideal. It's an ideal for us to reach, which I think we're going to talk about a lot tonight as well. But a good place to start would be, I think, with just the definition. How do you define utopia?
Yeah. So, you know, you and I were talking about this, and I just decided, you know what, I'm just going to go to the good old dictionary here.
Yeah, just cheat.
That's right. So it is defined as an imagined place or state of things in which everything is perfect. The word was first used in the book Utopia by Sir Thomas More, which we actually referenced in that dystopia.
Yeah, last time we talked about it.
In its origin, actually, I believe Thomas is the one who kind of coined this phrase, and it's based off of two Greek words. It's based off of the Greek word ou, which means not, and topos, which means place. So literally in the name, his inference was, this is not a place. This is not going to happen ever. Utopias are an idea. They are out there, but they are not a living entity. And from there, we'll just kind of, you know, springboard into some of the other things that we want to talk about with it.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is we had talked last time, dystopias are super popular right now. You know, mm-hmm. it's really easy, I think, to kind of take teen angst, particularly. And yeah. We talked about how, like, it's not fundamentally a young adult genre mm-hmm. or niche idea, but it's become that. Yeah. You know, like, the young adult network has kind of caught on to that and yes. just run with it. And, of course, a lot of that's down to Suzanne Clarke and The Hunger Games and mm-hmm. things like that. But I think when you get into the concept of the utopia, we don't really talk about that a lot because it's funny, a lot of the criticisms of utopia from a narrative perspective are, well, if everything's perfect, there's no conflict, you right. know? And if there's not a fundamental flaw, where's the drama? Which I kind of feel like that's more like our knee-jerk reaction to a society that's mostly attuned to dystopias. Mm-hmm. You know, we're so used to this idea that things have to be kind of dark and edgy, that drama always comes from
right.
the flawed element. However, I think we'll find as we talk about this, one of the things that just happened last week or the week before, we hit the 50th anniversary of Star Trek,
yes.
which is like huge. And of course, even though I think we can pick apart Star Trek, and we probably will later in this episode, and talk about how it's not a utopia, it's not a perfect place, Roddenberry's vision of a united federation
yeah.
where a lot of humanity's base struggles that we still have right, right. now have been eliminated or at right. least sort of tabled.
Yeah.
Which has allowed humanity to join its destiny in the stars, so mm-hmm. to speak. I kind of feel like in that the drama that happens in a Roddenberry Star Trek is, and they always had a term for this, like the Roddenberry box, where you couldn't right. get outside of the fact that the conflict always came from outside. It came yeah. from the conflict was what we encounter or what we confront as we discover new worlds.
Right.
And the initial series, I think that was definitely true of the original series and very much true of Next Generation.
Yes.
When you got into the later seasons of Deep Space Nine and Voyager more particularly, they dropped that and they started to go, as they called it, outside the Roddenberry box.
Yes.
And started to create some conflicts that were coming from within.
Right.
It's fair to say that in some of the movies, too, there was conflict from within
right.
Starfleet. Certainly Star Trek Beyond, not to give any spoilers, we have some conflict that's coming
yes.
in from human
yes.
human makings and human ideologies conflicting with one another. But I still think, by and large, if you take the concept of utopia, like Roddenberry was really trying to aim towards that, I mm-hmm. think. And I think he was trying to prove, too, that conflict and drama can happen without this flawed, miserable society
yeah.
that we live in.
Yeah. Well, and you and I are going to kind of get into the weeds a little bit more about the utopias. I think one of the things that make dystopias so easy for us to imagine and write about, from the perspective of a believer, you know, we've never shied away from that on this podcast. You know, I'm a believer. I think ultimately utopia will come sometime, but not in my lifetime. It will be after I've died. But here on Earth, I can progressively see things getting worse. And so it's easier.
And in some ways better, but harder
but,
to see
right,
the better.
Right.
Like it's always a balancing
right,
act.
Right. Well,
like,
within the definition of the dystopia, there's always a group of people that are living in a utopia. The people in Hunger Games who are living in the capital city are in some sense living in
right.
utopia.
It depends on which part of Trump
exactly,
Tower you live in.
Exactly.
Bam, made it political that quickly.
Bang. But I think that's the thing is that for, you know, we see and we're told in scripture that, you know, for us as believers, we're not going to be living in utopia here on earth, you know, and there are things that we appreciate and we love about this earth. I love my video games. I love my movies, as do you. You know, I enjoy those things. But you know, for our brothers and sisters who are in China, you know, we can see that they are clearly not living in that utopic society, even though, you know, Mao Zedong back in the day would have you think they were.
It's wonderful. There's a free kitten for everyone.
That's right. But, you know, moving beyond, even beyond that, I think it's much easier for people because we do look for the negative a lot of times. I think it's much more easy for people to cling to that idea of, oh yeah, things aren't great. You know, the good old days, you know, everybody, doesn't matter what generation you are.
Well, I think it takes a little bit of work to have that, because the problem with the utopian view, I think, is that it can seem very, and in some ways it is naive. People are like, well, it's a naivety sort of view to hold. I don't think that's wrong, but occasionally I think you have to put yourself out there and be willing to embrace something that's more optimistic than you might normally be. And I think this goes beyond just, you know, the believer's perspective, but I think everybody probably would agree that, like, we aren't living in a utopia,
right,
and we are not likely to get there. Not a utopia, but in the sense where everything is perfect. But I think what's interesting about fiction, that as we start to look at it, I don't think there is a utopia presented in any of these books particularly,
right,
or stories or movies or video games, whatever we're talking about,
right,
that is really perfect. I mean, I think a lot of them find that there is an underlying struggle or an underlying darkness or an underlying human flaw that can't be averted.
Right.
But I think the thing with the utopia is it's about striving against that and beyond that and over that. And that's something that's not necessarily the dystopia. It's usually, how in the heck did we get here?
Right.
And how do we not ever go here?
Right.
And I think utopia is like, hey, we're headed here. Come join us.
Yeah.
We can get. We might not get all the way there,
right,
but we can get here. And I think authors like Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke, like, they posited some of this, and Roddenberry too, in his own way. There were authors who really, really, really wanted to be there, but they also understood, to a certain degree, and maybe a different way than we might define it, human nature.
Yeah,
and I think what's an interesting thing, too, we have a series of kind of questions that we generated just to, you know, as we're going forward. But that question of, well, how has the concept of utopia in fiction? You go all the way to Thomas More and you work forward. It's going hand in hand with dystopias. But I think there's a lot of ways in which science fiction, speculative fiction, if you will, anything that asks that question of what if.
Yeah.
How has speculative fiction really influenced our world? Like,
yeah,
how have we gotten to where we are? I don't think we've gotten where we are without that dreamer's mentality that preceded that inventor's mentality.
Yeah. Well, and I agree with you 100%. I mean, just think about some of those things that we see when we look at, again, talking about Star Trek. The original Star Trek, having a device in your hand that you can flip and talk to someone thousands of miles away. I mean, that was pure science fiction to those people, the technologies. You know, I mean, you think about the computer systems that they had aboard the Starship Enterprise, even back in the original Star Trek, you know. I mean, at that time, you were talking about filling warehouses with computers. You know, the idea of something being able to fit on a desk or in a workspace station was completely foreign to people at that point. And so, you know, we see that in these ideas, in these dreams of, okay, technological advances, what are things that are going to help make our lives easier, so to speak? What are those things that are going to make our lives, quote unquote, better? We see that science fiction, many of the times, are throwing out those ideas and the people are catching them and saying, you know what, I can make that a reality for people. And so I think even in our technology, we see tremendous growth and expanse from those ideas that are coming into existence. Where, you know, you think about even 20 years ago, the concept of me being able to call someone and video chat live with them in real time across the world, you know, It was like dawning. People were getting a vision for it, but now it's Skype. It's here. It's every day.
Right. My kids who are part of that are going to be part of that generation that never
didn't know what it's like to be connected, where the idea of not being connected is a foreign thing. Like, I sometimes think about, like, oh my goodness, like the GPS is just a given these days, or like phone calls, or even like, it's funny because I think now, like, when we go on, if we want to know about a movie, we can't remember it. We just like hop on like Netflix or IMDb and we find it in minutes, and we can find it in YouTube. I remember a day when like I learned about movies by reading the TV Guide because I had no other way to get at anything, you know?
Waiting for the newspaper to come out to figure out, okay, what's going to be released this Friday.
Right. And so there's so much, the flow of information is different. I think what's interesting too, though, with Star Trek particularly, and many other really classic science fiction stories that did dare to think in the utopian vein, is they didn't just kind of precursor technological updates, but kind of like sociological boundaries and pushing them. And I think Star Trek in particular was a huge one. Obviously, back in the day, Roddenberry was always like, it's so funny now to hear them talking about, well, I'm trying to make his universe inclusive. But, like, you know, there was a lot of boundary pushing even back on the original show with, like, the first interracial kiss on television happens and occurs on Star Trek.
Right.
Under weird circumstances, to be sure. But, you know, Nichelle Nichols and William Shatner sharing the kiss. But, like, I think even, like, when you get into Next Generation and you start to have the he starts to explore the concept of what it means for Data, who technically could be seen as a servant or a piece of property, being a member of Starfleet, who's starting to develop his own sense of self over the course of the whole series. Like, those are ideas that kind of push out what a utopia is, because they also point out how it is not yet. And I think that was always what has been impressive about Star Trek. And I hope, though I'm cautiously optimistic about the new Star Trek that's coming out, they keep pegging it as progressive. Oh, we want to be progressive. Right. And so they're pushing in all these things. They want to make sure that we've adopted all the gender angles and stuff like that. And I guess there's something to be said about all that. But at the same time, progressive is never, I was reading, you and I probably looked at the same article, progressive is never what Star Trek has ever really been about. Star Trek was not a progressive society, it was a utopian society.
Right.
So it was aiming at a very particular thing. So for it to simply attempt to be progressive, to keep up with the times, I don't think that's the general gist of utopia. It doesn't want to keep up with the times. It wants to
transcend
the times, in a sense, predict and telegraph the times by giving us an ideal that we can run to and meet.
Yeah.
And I think Roddenberry's world, as much as any other, was a good example of that. Mostly because, in its own way, it was still very grounded in our real world. It didn't completely imagine a universe with humans weren't being a part of it and human frailty being a part of it.
Yeah. So let me ask you, Nathan, we spent some time here talking about things that are, you know, pushing us as a society into more of a utopia. Are there ever any quote unquote improvements we just shouldn't make? Where's the line? Where is that sense of, okay, this is going to be good, let's pursue this. This thing may not be good, let's not pursue this. Thoughts on that?
I think that's like kind of the classic question too, even if it's not always phrased that way, because it gets into the difference between a utopia and a dystopia. The characters in the Hunger Games who, and I think you and I maybe think you brought this up last time, that does President Snow view himself as the bad guy? Most likely not, you know?
Right.
Do the people that invented Big Brother in 1984, or not, no, am I right? 1984 is Big Brother.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Did the people who invented Big Brother in 1984 think that what they were doing was wrong? No, the people burning books in Fahrenheit 451, even down, I mean, that's the whole crux of the story with the main character. But nobody in these dystopian worlds believes they're doing the wrong thing. In fact, they think they're doing the very right thing by humanity and giving humanity what it needs to continue and to exist, which is where we get into that question of any updates, any upgrades, any improvements that could be seen as going too far.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting, and I shared with you the article where they're talking about how there's a lot of a guy who talks a lot about utopias and things like this, Elon Musk, who, you know, he's been recently involved in like SpaceX and stuff like that. I think currently getting sued, but there's a lot going on there. But, you know, he has for years talked about, he sinks a lot of money into AI research, which is interesting because technically Elon Musk is saying he is very, 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 very skeptical and actually concerned and worried about the development of AI and how, right. you know, well, how do we know what AI will do? Maybe it'll gather us all up and inoculate us with drugs and make us all happy, you know, well, Prozac us all.
Right.
Because it thinks that's what people should be, you know, that's kind of that Matrix or Skynet kind of thing. It's not as optimistic as Vicky from Small Wonder.
Right.
But the idea there is he puts money into it not so much because he wants to see AI develop per se, but he was someone who has the financial means to do so and maybe some of the technical perspective wants to keep an eye on how it's developed.
Right.
You know, which I think is an interesting perspective because it's not that Luddite perspective of, oh God, this is coming and I don't want to touch it, so we'll just keep our hands off of
right.
it. You know, I think it's like, well, if it's going to happen or if people are pursuing it, then we need to be the watchdogs or the guardians of it. So it's interesting, I think, to hear some of these people talk about they're very big fans of utopia, but they're also a little concerned about what we would see as some of those utopian perspectives. You know, you could create a utopian world, and one of the authors that Musk likes, Ian Banks, has created a utopia that's pretty much run by sentient spaceships, you know, who seem to be doing everything right, but they have all the power. They have all the control. They decide what's done. That is really, really good until they decide not to do things the way the people who are being served by them, you know, want. So I think anything in that vein, and we go back to Gattaca, I think when we want to improve things to a point of perfection is actually the very point where we fall and trip up.
Right.
Like, trying to achieve, aiming for perfection is okay. Literally trying to achieve it and getting within its grasp and continuing to push, I think is where we fail because we as humans don't know anything but imperfection.
Right. And I agree. And I think many times the things that we are trying to make perfect, and I use, and I put that term in quotes, perfection is a very subjective thing for us as humans. And a lot of times we talk about physical characteristics, you know, Gattaca in particular, you know, was the invalids or the invalids that were not perfect.
Perfect eyesight, being able to run, your heart being able to beat this many, you know, that sort of thing.
And so what you do is you take away from the fact that, okay, so if you're trying to make things perfect, then these certain people will not function. And you think about a mind like Stephen Hawking, if he lived in that Gattaca society, he never would have risen to where he is today, a mind like that. They would have just seen, oh, well, you know, he's predisposed to this, and so he's just going to, you know, run of the mill. He's never going to have a chance to excel, and that's it. And we run the risk of losing out on so many things when we try to put a specific definition on what perfection is.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, and I don't mean it's in a devil advocate's way, but in a reality looking at it, it's interesting because I think a lot of sci-fi writers probably, you know, the ones who share their childhoods grew up not being part of that elite, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it's probably, it's an interesting fact too that a lot of the writers responsible for pausing this, you know, they were probably bookworms, they were probably sort of like, they were not part of that physical or idealized elite. So the flip side of that could be that guys like one of the articles pointed out, guys like Musk and Zuckerberg, you know, maybe are they even necessary? Do we even need them in a utopian society? You know, do you need these rich entrepreneurs in a world that functions without, that no longer needs to worry about, will there be enough food? Will there be enough capacity?
Right.
And things like that. But those questions always exist. And
right.
as we try to solve them, there's always the question of how far do we go?
Right.
So I think that's interesting.
Well, the interesting thing is, as we try to move into a perfect society, the reality is, and you mentioned this earlier, Nathan, we need perfect people in order to run a perfect society. So, you know, what we find is that it's going to be lost on us, because the whole idea behind communism, I mean, if you read communism and you look at how communism is set up, it's utopic. On paper, it is the closest thing that you will ever get to having a quote unquote perfect governmental system here on Earth. where's the problem? Well, the problem is it's still in the hands of people, and people are flawed, and people are greedy. That's why when you look at China and you look, there is such a huge dichotomy of people. There really is no middle class for the most part. There's rich people and there's poor people. The rich people have the good jobs. They're working in the good places and they're in government. They're this, they're that. They're making all the money and there's nothing, there's a gap there. You look at Cuba, it's the same thing. Ethiopia is still trying to recover from the effects of communism when it came into the country. And so there's this huge discrepancy that we see between something that's written down on paper and something that looks good and something that sounds good and actually putting it into practice with people who aren't good.
Right. Flawed people who aren't going to act like the automatons you expect.
Right.
I think to be fair to many of the authors, whether you're talking about Arthur C. Clarke or even authors earlier than that, like even the way back to Moore, when he writes Utopia, he talks about like the way the world is and how perfect it is, but like through his lens, whether this was Moore being satirical or himself just being, you know, like his society was not perfect. I mean, I think his society was like, women don't ever speak in Utopia. Right. It's like, wait, what? So things like that, his utopia, again, is only utopia for certain cross-section of society. There's a society, a part of that society that is repressed. And, you know, they've pointed out that even in Star Trek, we primarily see the lives of Starfleet
right.
in Star Trek, who are arguably, I think, in more of that 1% sort of perspective. We don't really, only in a couple of the movies and in a couple of the shows, do we ever really see the perspective of those more impoverished people that must be out there somewhere.
Right.
You know, we get this idea that everybody's living some bountiful life, but we never really see, you know, there has to be someone who has less than everybody else
right.
in a society. So where are they in Star Trek? And I think that might be one of those aspects that any version so far of Roddenberry's story hasn't really looked at
right.
too closely.
Right. Or if it is looked at, it's looked at through the lens of the foreign aliens that they come in contact with, and many times, I can't remember if you said this on the podcast or offline, but many times they're viewed as the enemy. They're the ones who are creating the war to try to get more than what they have. They're the ones who are engaging in the conflict because there's something that they want that they don't have.
Right, and they're always kind of seen through that role of the usurper. And in fact, some of the, like, in my opinion, lesser Star Trek movies were like that. Insurrection comes to mind.
Yeah.
Even more so than Insurrection, Star Trek Nemesis, which I think I had as like the bottom of the barrel right. of the Star Trek movies. But like Nemesis does have a character who was raised in a mine, but it right. wasn't a Federation mine. You know, it was
right.
Like a Romulan mine or something. So I think I think that most fiction that deals with utopias does not have that perfect model.
Yeah.
So there is that. There's also a sense that if you look hard enough under the veneer of a utopia, I think you do find a dystopia or the seeds of a dystopia.
Yeah.
And I think in some of my favorite stories, if you go back to like Ursula K. Le Guin, who wrote, and I think I mentioned the dystopias. Nathan, did you ever read a short story called The Ones Who Walk Away from the Omalas?
No, I have not.
Okay. And I won't really spoil too much of that here, but it's a story that essentially presents us, and in a lot of ways, the story is fantasy, maybe more so than science fiction, because it doesn't have any like advancements or anything, but it rather predicts like this perfect, wonderful city that seems to operate in a way that we all would want it to operate. It is a perfect definition of utopia, but then she reveals that there is this one dark element, this one kind of, if lack of a better term, a sacrifice that has to be made, and it's actually kind of a very appalling one. It's a continual sort of trade-off for the utopia.
Yeah.
That for the utopia to exist, this really, really bad thing must happen to this very innocent person
right.
in order to keep the thing working. And at some point, every person who's a part of that society will have to go down to this particular room, see this particular thing happening, and then make the decision. Do I keep living here
right.
knowing that they're down in the basement, or do I have to leave?
Yeah.
And that's kind of like the gist. And I think that
in a lot of ways, that concept is central to a lot of stories. Mm-hmm. Like, if people are listening to this and are looking for good stories, like Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End comes to mind, which is a story where aliens come down and basically, you know, within a very short frame of time, have provided us with all the tools to basically create a golden age of peace. But there is a trade-off. There is something they're not telling us,
right.
And there's something that we may lose in the bargain.
Process, yeah.
And I wouldn't consider that a dystopia. It's a utopia with a hook, with a moment where we have to pay the piper.
Yeah. Well, all right. So let's be fair. In the truest sense of what a utopia looks like, I think we can agree that it's never going to happen. I mean, even within the very definition of utopia, the root words, not a place, you know, we're never going to find that. So let's kind of bring it more into the realm of reality. How do we make progress so that we are better tomorrow than where we are today? How do we make those strides into the future where, let's take something like hunger. Okay, because that's a huge thing that you find in utopias. No one's going hungry. Could we ever get to a place in society where, all right, maybe there's still fighting going on, maybe there's still killing going on, maybe people are still homeless, but people are being fed. Is there ever a time that we would be able to address in literature, in whatever it might be, that there is a semi-utopia? And kind of what I'm getting in a roundabout way is, you know, looking at maybe pieces like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. You and I were talking, the Shire in J.R.R. Tolkien's book seems to be a utopic place. It's not perfect, but it does a good job of portraying the idyllic lifestyle, so to speak. Your thoughts on that, writings of Lewis and Tolkien, and maybe not getting to a perfect society, but a more idyllic society.
Wow, I thought you were going to ask me a hard question. Well, to back up to the question you asked, where, like, can we ever get these places? You mentioned hunger as an example. I think that, again, that's kind of the heart or the crux or the key place to start with a potential for a really good story or a really good concept, which is how can we? And more importantly, I think, from my mind, is less than how can we? Because, you know, to be honest, the reality of sustainability when we get to food sources and things like that and being able to cure these issues, I mean, is not a reality, but it could be one day. In terms of just solely, could we solve the issue of there's enough food for everybody? I don't know, but it seems like, let's say we do solve that problem. The bigger question is going to be, how will we ever ensure that no one ever exploits it? Mm-hmm. And that may be more the pessimist in me, but I think that it's less this question. We very well may get to a point where we cure the issue of hunger, where it may be no longer a driving issue. But once it is not, and if it is not, then you suddenly have other issues to worry about, because suddenly a lot of people that were only thinking about what will I eat tomorrow will no longer be thinking about that. Mm-hmm. They're now thinking about where will I live and who will I live with and why do you have what I want? And then eventually when there's nothing left, it'll be like, why are you worshiping that God when you should be worshiping this God or something else?
Sure.
You know, I don't want to target religion solely. But the point is, I think as we, the part of the fantasist, of the philosopher, whatever you want, is always considering, once we solve this problem, what you've just achieved, at some level you're achieving that you've either garnered longer life for more people that wouldn't normally be alive because of what you've done. You've now made an advancement in medicine. There are more people around than there were before. You've just made an advancement in food. Well, where are you going to put those people now? I mean, it sounds kind of, you know, I guess harsh to say something like that. But once we solve one problem, we have another one arise. And I think that, like, one of the elements is always considering, what will we do with our humanity, particularly when there's more of people to share it with?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just an issue of finding more space for us. It's finding the proper mindset or heart space, so to speak, to live with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all that's a part of it. How does that tie into what you're saying? Is like one of the questions we were asking, well, can utopias, utopia is always kind of, I feel like it's often cited in the same breath with science fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, it all, and because we've been mostly talking here tonight about advancements in science and advancements in our living space, we often think of utopia with science fiction. But I think that when we get to particularly Tolkien, Lewis is hard because he often wrote allegories. Mm-hmm. And so allegories have this element where they sit apart from the real world and they're not asking so much a real question, but they're trying to make you think about a different idea over here.
Right.
But I think that certainly some of Lewis's work has elements of that. I think Lewis and Le Guin, but rather Tolkien and Le Guin are maybe better examples because they often wrote stories that were closer to pure fantasy, but I think they had those elements. They asked real questions about utopian society. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about like the Shire, like you were talking about, it is idyllic. It seems to have not had a war for a very long time. Mm-hmm. The hobbits have more than enough to eat, obviously. They have right. like three breakfasts. But in that, even in the beginning of the Shire storyline, there are still like some struggles and some strife and some basic what we would consider human frailty involved. I mean, you even in the beginning, if the story were never to expand beyond the Shire, the Sackwith Baggins is a kind of right. the bad guy. You know, they're sort of the antagonists, I guess, if right. you will. And they want to take the Shire and like, not the Shire, but Bagend from Frodo after Bilbo leaves and those things. And of course, those elements like the Sackwith Baggins, those are very much reduced when... And let me say, too, yes, there are going to be some mild spoilers in here for Lord of the Rings. So if you haven't read Lord of the Rings and you want to keep yourself unspoiled...
At this point, if you haven't read Lord of the Rings, I'm sorry, I don't feel bad.
Fair enough. But I'm just saying, maybe you're sitting there thinking, I was going to get to it one day. I only say this because 99 times out of 10, if you haven't read the books, you've seen the movies.
Right.
But guess what? They cut the Scouring of the Shire, and I'm about to talk about it. So at the end of the story, this is after Frodo and Sam... Really, Frodo has, really, Gollum has destroyed the ring. Right. The ring's been destroyed. Middle Earth life can go on as it was. Right. Frodo's essentially saved everybody, including the Shire. But when he gets back, it's in massive upheaval. Yeah. It's nothing like the place he remembers.
Yeah.
Which is where we get back into sort of like, I think Tolkien sort of exercising his post-war life. Yeah. He comes back, and the world, the sanctity, Britain being this kind of sacred place almost that was immune or inoculated from this sort of thing, has been hit with the one thing it always wanted to be apart from, which is it now has a problem.
Right.
Sharky is really, Saruman has taken over, and Wormtongue's there with him, and they've taken over the Shire, and even the Sackwith Baggins is all their petty little issues. They're now right alongside everyone else. They're being victimized. And when Frodo and Sam have to come back, and in some ways I think it's like one of the strongest parts of The Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
I can see why it was cut from the films, but it's very, very poignant where the hobbits, and Gandalf even recognizes this when he sends them off, they have to do this themselves.
Right.
Like, this is on them. Granted, Frodo just took a ring to Mount Doom and will never be the same because of it. But if he wants to regain what he had, if he wants to get Utopia back, they're going to have to do some very unutopic things. They're going to basically have to not be pacifists for a change. They're going to have to not just be gardeners and farmers.
Right.
And I think that's one of the interesting things that Tolkien gets at, is that pacifism in and of itself will not let us actually reach utopia, because eventually some other force will come in and corrupt it for us if we're not willing to fight for it.
Yeah.
And I think that's... There's a lot of elements in the story of the ring where, you know, even you get characters like Tom Bombadil and stuff like this who aren't affected by the ring, but also don't really, you know, what do they care so much?
Right.
Like, there's an element that this little hobbit who's willing to take it to Mount Doom, even though he himself is still flummoxed because of his humanity, you know, ultimately it's Providence that destroys the ring. It's not Frodo. And in that, there's still this sense of people, flawed people willing to strive and willing to do a harder thing, are what allows the Shire to exist. I think that, like, one of the things Tolkien is saying through the entire Lord of the Rings is the Shire gets to exist. The Shire gets to be there for Sam and his children and his wife because the fact that Frodo gives it up and he says, the Shire was saved. It wasn't saved for me.
Right.
I don't get to have it. I've got to sail beyond the seas. And in some ways, places like Numenor and the worlds of the elves, they're closer to utopia, but they're also a little detached. And even Tom Bombadil's weird little sing-songy existence out in the woods. I mean, Tom Bombadil seems so detached that it's like, you know, I don't know. Yeah, he's susceptible to the ring, but maybe we shouldn't leave with him because who knows what'll do it. Like, he's just sort of, he's disconnected.
Well, I think the interesting thing about those characters is the same thing that I try to impress upon my students when I was teaching. You know, I had many of my students who were either very conservative or very liberal. Students, and let's be real, many adults don't have a well-viewed perspective of life. Many of my conservative students were afraid, you know, that, oh, you know, all these bad things are going to happen to America if certain people get in office. And if that happens, then it's going to be the end of the world.
Right.
And
we can't live in Trumplandia.
Right. I try to remind them that, well, wait a minute, guys, Rome, which existed for close to 2,000 years, okay, rose, it went through a lifespan, and it died. Was that the end of the world? No, it moved on. People who are further away from history should have the added advantage of looking back on history and seeing how things play out. I think Tom Bombadil is one of those characters that has lived. I mean, I think basically he's been around since the beginning from what the book describes. That
There's lots of people have different theories. Some people think he's sort of a god analog. Right. I don't think that that's really the case. Kind of just because of the fact he is impervious to the ring. He puts it on, nothing happens.
Right.
So the question.
Well, he can see right Frodo when Frodo puts it on. And.
And Frodo's kind of question is, well, why, you know, like there's that temptation of, why don't we just leave the ring with Tom, like, and just go on? Like, Tom, why doesn't Tom take the ring to Mordor? Right. And there's this implication that, well, Tom will probably just forget about the ring, put it somewhere else, and replace it.
Because, and I think part of that is because Tom has lived through so much of the world at that point that his concern isn't with the rise and fall of good and evil, and he knows that there will always be good people who will rise up and subdue evil. He knows that there will always be evil people that will rise up and try to subdue good and take over. And so from his perspective, he just kind of lays back and takes it all in and is like, I'm just here living my life. This is something that if you guys want to engage in the fight, it's not for him. His view of, again, what you said, providence. He knows things are going to take care of themselves.
And though I do think that in that, this is my personal opinion, I kind of feel that Tolkien, I don't want to even say he's necessarily criticizing it, but I think he's pointing out how that view of ultimate pacifism is not, while it's a great, maybe a utopian ideal, it's not actually an ideal that can be, it's not pragmatic in the real world. Like, I think at some level Tolkien is saying, if there isn't a Frodo who's willing to take the ring to Mordor, that you can kiss all this goodbye, Tom Bombadil. Right. And even point out that Tom Bombadil, that's where you get the idea of him being the first. He says, we'll be the first and he'll be the last. That after Sauron has destroyed everything else, Tom will go too. He won't be able to withstand it. Eventually, it will be his problem.
Right.
But at that point, it will be too late.
Right. Yeah, but I think there's this idea that, yeah, I agree with you. I think you're right. I think there's something in there that this has to be fought for. But I think too, Tolkien's trying to point out that there are three main archetypes in life. There's good, there's bad, and there's not necessarily neutral, but there's the one who looks and observes and says, this fight that's going on is greater than and goes outside of the scope of any of the players that are in this room. And you get more of a scope of that, like when you read the Silmarillion and you find out how much greater Tolkien's world has expanded beyond what we see in Lord of the Rings, you know, and Bombadil seems to have that history, that knowledge of all the things that are going on, that, there is a providence at work. He's not a part of that making of the warring, the good and the evil. He's there. He's living his life. He's an observer. I think he does understand that things need to be done, but he's not the one to do it. He's there saying that, you know what, if evil rises up and it comes to power and it takes over, there is going to be someone good who's going to come and destroy it.
But yeah, and I do think there may be a level too where Tolkien is in a little way, again, not criticizing, but pointing out that viewpoint, if one chooses to accept it, the problem is that if the world is only full of Tom Bombadils,
correct,
then evil will rise. If the war is coming, and I think this comes a lot from Tolkien being involved in the war and then writing Lord of the Rings while he's in kind of caught up in the midst of World War II, mm-hmm. You know, he's seen these things and he's understanding. I mean, obviously there's a lot of imagery that is a little sort of like Frodo and Sam, and not just Frodo and Sam, but Merry and Pippin, and mm-hmm. really a lot of the characters get involved in a level where it's like they're through the trenches. They're going through the trenches.
Sure.
And though he also kind of creates a secondary indictment, which moves a little bit to what you're saying, where each of the characters kind of has to decide, how much can I do? Mm-hmm. And I think this is where you'd mentioned Silmarillion comes in, is there's a point in Lord of the Rings where I think even more so than Frodo being tempted by the ring, Samwise, who's my favorite character in the books, mm-hmm. he gets tempted by the ring and he sees what he would do with the ring if he had it. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, what could go wrong? I'll make everything like my home back in Bag End, my little gardens that I tended to. In that vision, he kind of understands. He makes the choice. He's one of the few people to kind of like throw the ring's temptations off without, you know. He basically realizes that it isn't going to work out for everybody if he makes the world just like his.
Right.
His garden. Because where he belongs is not here, per se. He doesn't belong making world-changing decisions on a grand stage, which is interesting because when you finally find out who Sauron is mm-hmm. in the Silmarillion, what he was before he was the Dark Lord, that's basically what Sauron was. He wanted to do what Gandalf says in the beginning, where he says, if you gave these to me, I would do this out of a desire to do good, but I could do really bad stuff with this. And that's kind of what happens with Sauron. He's not a dark figure to begin with.
No.
He's a guy who has a vision and wants to change things. He wants to bring about utopia on Middle Earth, but that's not what happens.
Right. Well, what's interesting is, you know, the whole scene is set, you know, really, you know, in the beginning of the Silmarillion, you have this creator and, you know, creates essentially these angelic beings who also have the ability to create. And this creator creates this utopia. And right from the very get-go, there is one of the angels wants to divert and do its own thing. And kind of, you know, they're all playing this chord, this harmony together, and it's beautiful. And this one angel essentially throws a little bit of heavy metal into Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, so to speak. You know, it doesn't fit, you know. And so we see, even from the very beginning in this creation, that things are upset and things are not going to go according to plan. And again, you have the creator who overwatches everything, but really the focus, particularly in the Silmarillion, comes down to these angelic creatures. And you then see the formation of the elves, you see the formation of the dwarves and the humans and everything that goes on. And you see that always there's this discord that comes in, that while, you know, the creatures are trying to create this perfect society and have these people live in harmony with one another and live together, there's always discord among them and there's never a peace. And that's, you know, that's really what you have going into the Lord of the Rings, is this huge, you know, thousands of years of history of, you know, okay, we're going to try to set up peace. And we have this pseudo peace for a little bit, but wait, there's still this evil in the world. So even though evil is subdued at this point, it's going to rise up and it's going to throw chaos into the mix. And then we'll subdue it for a little bit and then it's going to rise up. Even in the Lord of the Rings, after you have total peace, so you have Aragorn and Arwen ruling in, Minas Tirith, and the rightful king has been restored, and you have the hobbits who have conquered the Shire, and, you know, Frodo and Sam for a period of time even goes across the sea and to live out, you know, a semi-eternity in peace. Eventually everyone must die, but they live out this semi-existence in peace. What we find is in later stories, there's more turmoil that comes up because there's never a full contentment of peace. And you find out in The Lord of the Rings, in that story, again, through the Silmarillion and all of the subset stories, that that only comes at the end of days.
Right. And essentially, you know, there's only going to be peace when there's no more people.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Middle Earth of any kind or any race.
Right.
And I guess that's kind of the thing where, like, some critics have come in and, you know, particularly when you try to layer utopia or its ideals or its concepts into the real world, the question is, so if utopia is not achievable, if it is a pipe dream in a sense, mm-hmm. is it really useful to have a utopia in fiction and in our mythology? Like, what purpose does utopia serve if we can't get there?
Yeah, I think the utopia is what we long for. I think ultimately everyone longs for utopia. I think even, let me take, you know, one of the most vile villains in history, Adolf Hitler. And I'm not condoning in any way anything Adolf Hitler did. So let me put that out there.
Thank you for that disclaimer.
Because I know we're going to get some kind of nasty text or email or something. Wait, did you just say that?
I'll send you one.
Let me just put that out there. But even in Hitler's mind, he was looking for a utopia. His idea of what utopia would look like was messed up, but that's what he was looking for. And I think there is an innate idea in all of us as people to want that utopia. And I think that in there lies some of the problem, is that in each and every one of us, that might look different. What that looks like, what utopia looks like, is going to be different. But no, I think that's the usefulness, is it allows us to express that longing that we all have, that desire that we all have. We talked about Tolkien quite a bit. We look at C.S. Lewis and his writings, and you said, you know, they're largely allegorical, and they are. But what I love is there's a scene in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader when Aslan is speaking with Lucy and Edmund before they're about to leave Narnia for the last time. And he talks to them about, you know, showing them a vision of Narnia, and that, and the reason why he brought them to the world was so that in their world, they would also know and understand who Aslan was. So by bringing him to his world, he could reveal himself fully as who he was. So when they go back to their world, they would be able to find him and know him by his name in their world. And so there's this idea that Lewis even captures, that, you know, you're looking for something that is ideal. You're looking for the perfect thing, and somebody needs to show you what that is. I think that's totally useful. I think the issue that we're going to run into is what, you know, we have a problem when Hitler's utopia, you know, conflicts with what someone else's utopia looks like. You know, that's where the problem is. It's not that fantasizing and thinking about what utopia and what that might look like. It's, well, wait a minute, what happens when your idea of utopia and my idea of utopia now clash? Well, now we have war. And we're getting further away from that concept.
If we're moving in that direction.
Right.
And I see your point. And I think that is a decent point to make, which is that, like, a individual's idea of a utopia, like, even though they may flunk it and fail it at every single level, if it were presented to, say, some board, you know.
Right.
Well, here we're going to decide if yours is utopia. That is a negative.
Right.
But certainly a twisted mind, one who's been twisted by, you know, bitterness or things like that, you know, may view a perfect society as one where there aren't any people in it, mm-hmm. or only people of a certain kind. I don't want this flavor of donut. They're only going to be sprinkle donuts where I come from. And the whole concept, I think, of utopia does go beyond, it can, but like you're saying, some people can have this view. I think, though, that part of the dreaming mentality of a utopia is being able to put ideas out there that may catch on in a positive way. And I think that it ideas that suggest how we can improve, how we can, and not for the good of just the one, but you know, that maybe potentially for the good of many. Is it going to be perfectly achievable? No, it's not. And I think that's the thing to keep in mind, is it isn't going to be perfectly achievable, and there will be points in time where people will want to take something that has been very, that has been done for the good of everybody, and use it for the benefit of one,
right,
which may actually end up being at the ill of everybody.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on there. And I mean, we could talk for hours probably about those kinds of things. But I do think it's an interesting, it'd be interesting too, I think, it might be a nice exercise for you and me to just find some examples of utopias in fiction and things like that, that are things that we can recommend. You know, that someone out here wants to read something a little different, who might be a little bit sick and tired of dystopias, would know where to start. And I think maybe we can put some of those up on the Facebook page or something. But I think it's an interesting topic. I'd love to do more of this in the series, maybe looking at things. We talked about apocalyptic fiction or even post-apocalyptic fiction, and what does that look like and how does that differ?
Sure. Very cool. Man, this has been a great first time back.
It's a little bit headier than our usual discussions, I know. Think.
But when you get into something like that, it really, you got to be. I mean, it's just...
It makes me want to go back and read Lord of the Rings again.
Yeah.
I feel like, I'm like, wow, there's a lot there. Or even the Silmarillion, which is a little daunting.
Yeah.
But, I'm getting excited because my kids are just starting to get to the point where they'll sit and listen to chapter books. So we're Dr. Doolittle. So we're going to keep working from Dr. Doolittle. We did a little bit of Benicula, too.
Nice.
I remember that, the Vampire Rabbit.
Right.
And maybe we can work our way to The Hobbit. So I'm excited because I'm finally like, getting to that place where maybe they can... They were watching snippets of Narnia or I think the Dawn Treader the other night, and they were kind of getting into it a little bit. So
sweet. That's awesome, man. All right, well, we're gonna go ahead and sign it off now. Catch you later.
Take care. See ya.